This evening we're going to spend a few moments in Romans 8. I was thinking about part of this passage today, and it and you know, and as I started looking at the over broader context, it was just a very helpful reminder of truths and things. So I thought maybe it'd be a profitable time for us to reflect upon it for a few minutes this evening. The especially these past few days with being able to one of these kind of like if you ever watched that TV show Monk, his observational skills and obsessions, he'll go, it's a blessing and a curse. And having the ability to have frequent updates from Germany is, in some ways, is very clearly a blessing. In some ways, it's like a curse, because it's things that before we would have heard about, and then a week later heard about. It brings you so into it, which is very good in one sense, but it's also very draining. And then, not having this little ice storm and being at home for 3 days, I've had much more time and attention to focus on it than I would have in other settings too. And this afternoon, I just kind of got to that point of, what do you say now? And what is your prayer now? And I was thinking about this passage in Romans 8:26. It says, "In the same way, the Spirit also helps our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we should, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words." And that's kind of what I was thinking about, was like, I've had privilege from time to time to be with people that are very eloquent in their praying. And I don't think eloquence is necessarily God. He's going to hear the eloquent prayer over the non-eloquent prayer. But I think we all would desire for not just the fact that we prayed, but what we say or whatever, to be encouragements. And yet, I found myself just almost drained of words. It's like, what do you say now? What is the prayer now when you've been praying? And because of the blogs, and maybe if you write things, then you're expressing that, and so you kind of, you just write the same thing, which is not wrong, or is it a requirement to write things, which is definitely not. But nevertheless, I found myself in that sense. So I looked, I was looking at this passage, and what a comfort there is that in that sense of, when we get to that point where, and I'm not sure why we get there, whether it's just from the very beginning, we simply do not know how to word it. We simply do not know what to ask for. Or that we're perplexed or we're drained, to know that there's still this relationship with God that is so beyond our understanding, that it comes to a point where he basically saying, if you cannot verbalize it, don't panic, because my spirit knows your spirit, and I can interpret for you. But with that, then, to start looking at the whole context that leads up to that, and it's very interesting. If you look in verse 12, begin there, of chapter 8, So then, brethren, we are under obligation not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. But if you are living according to the flesh, you must die. But if by the Spirit you are putting to death the deeds of the flesh body, you will live. For all who are being led by the Spirit of God, these are sons of God. For you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons, by which we cry out, Abba, Father. And just think for a moment that relationship that it's focusing on there. That this contrast in this fallen world, you know, what is directing us? What are we living our lives according to? Is it according to a physical world or a spiritual world? Is it according to the flesh, according to the Spirit? But, you know, it comes down to what is leading us? What is directing our lives? And it says, if it's the Spirit of God, then we're children. And then this reminder, we have not received a spirit of slavery. If salvation was that if you would trust God, if you would, whatever, God's provided something for your forgiveness, and by seeking that forgiveness, you would move from a kingdom of being slaves to sin to a kingdom of just being a slave to God, that's a pretty good deal. I'd vote for it, if I was rational at that time, if I was thinking without a depraved mentality, it's a good deal, I'll take it. But it's not just that we're not slaves. I mean, there's one sense we might say we're servants, but not that same degree of slavery where someone is just that, dreadful master. But it says not that this slavery is not one that leads to fear again. So it's not going back. So there might be a sense you say, well, I'm a slave to God. But it's not the slavery that puts you back in fear. In contrast to that, as opposed to receiving a spirit or disposition of fear, we've received a disposition, a status of adoption. And so we're not slaves in this context, but children. And it puts us in that relationship where we cry out, Abba, Father. In recent years, some studies on Abba suggest that it really doesn't take on that highest quality of intimacy that it was once thought to be. But it still is a different form that suggests, this sense of closeness, this intimacy with God. Then he moves on. He says, the Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we're children of God. See, these are the things that remind us that we're children. That are as confirmation that we're children. Are we being led by the Spirit? Do we have that relationship to cry out to God as Abba Father? And I'm definitely not, the thing about ever saying anything about prayer is you don't want to suggest that there's this right way to pray and this wrong way to pray, because then that creates problems. And so I'm not surely not trying to suggest that. But I found myself this week much more inclined to say Father than Lord or God. And I can't tell you necessarily why. I don't think it's like there's a truth there and it's the right truth. I'm not trying to say that. But it was I found my prayers more going in the sense of Father and child. And that we're his children. Even when I was looking at Scripture and kind of paraphrasing Scripture, Scripture often would have servants, and I was changing that to children because it was that relationship that was communicating with me this week. And that's what we see here, is that this testimony relationship is that we're children. And if children, heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, so that we may also be glorified with him. And so in this early part, in verses 12 to 17, it's looking at this relationship, and it's many-fold. There's this sense of being led by God, this relationship that moves into a prayer where we cry out, and then there's this connection of heirs, that there's this this long-lasting relationship that extends beyond now. Then in verse 18, he continues, says, "For I consider that the suffering of this present time, the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." The sufferings, and the scriptures replete with passages about suffering, and the sufferings times are general, like in James where it talks about various trials will come our way. And so, I understand James to be just nondescript, that there are challenges that come in life. Some of Paul's writings, when he talks about suffering, it's very clear that those sufferings have to do with being in ministry. You know, that it's your call as a Christian, your stand up for the gospel, your whatever that creates that. It's not necessarily, that you got the flu or that you broke your leg. It's specifically that you took a stand. And so they can be in various ways of that. But this seems to be that broad sense of sufferings in the present time. Not necessarily that, suffering because you're standing up for the gospel or that you're preaching a Christ, but just that, life, because that's the more the context here. But the sufferings of this age, which sometimes are overwhelming, and to think about Eric and Belinda, it's in a setting like that. That's there's no way you can truly say I identify or I know how to feel. There is a possibly, depending on what you've experienced, you can definitely say I have an identification, I have a comprehension, depending on what your setting is, but to say that that doesn't even truly compare to the glory. I mean, that gives you a perspective of what the glory is then. And so all of a sudden this passage, it doesn't give you this confidence. I mean, that particular passage, if you're looking at it in terms of prayer and wanting, our desires for somebody to be healed, definitely doesn't put us in that sense of, well, this is a confirmation healing is going to take place in our timetable. But how greater than our timetable? I long to see this miracle here for a variety of reasons. And it's not to say that it wouldn't be of great value, of great comfort. But there is a point when we're talking about our prayers that relate to temporal life in this situation or another that apart from the rapture, all of us will one day experience death. To be delivered from that from time to time is definitely worthy of prayer and worthy of praise. But how much greater the thought that there is this glory that's far beyond even how we would compare that. He moves on, he says, "For the anxious longing of the creation awaits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now." And, it's that fresh reminder that something is drastically wrong with the world we live in. And there's something about an untimely death that undoes us. When somebody has been sick for an extended period of time, we come, or some come to the place of saying, you know, it was a blessing that God delivered them from the pain. And depending on how that's worded, I don't necessarily think that's wrong to feel that way or pray that way. I've heard it in settings where I didn't think it was right, but generally would not say it's wrong. Remember a lady that was, she had had the polio as a young lady, and then it had reoccurred in her life in her later years, and she was in her late 70s and maybe early 80s, and was very restricted mobility all the time I knew her, and toward the end, you know, was not even able to get out in a wheelchair and was in hospice care, and so, you know, it's that common assumption that her passing is somewhere in the near future. There's another lady that was in her mid-40s that was diagnosed with a brain tumor, and about 6 weeks later, or 2 months later, I can't remember, but somewhere in a very short period of time died. And these deaths occurred a day apart. And I just remember people's reactions. The younger lady, this was an untimely death, and it frightened people because it put it in that proximity of where they were. Yet when they looked at the older lady's death, it was that she had lived a good life, and it was expected, and she was delivered, and there was just such a difference in the way that people generally talked about it. And yet when I looked at the two husbands, I couldn't see a difference in pain. And I think sometimes we look at these things to comfort ourselves, and we say things that we find comforting that have no basic theological truth. We don't find the death of an elderly person or a person that's been sick for a long time all that theologically difficult, because we've come to accept that death is natural. And there's a certain part of us to say, well, if I was in that situation, I would rather go to be to heaven than here. But then when somebody's full of vitality, we say, there's something wrong with this. And yet, there's something wrong with all of it. Well, you know, we've become accustomed to death in a certain setting, and that's where we react. But creation is all out of whack. And you just got to love the way Paul puts it, that creation groans. Now, you know, if you only had some limited things from Paul, Paul sounds very New Age, you know. Talking about, I mean, creation's alive, you know. Creation is groaning, and, you know, just. But yet, when you think about it, I mean, everything in the earth, everything, you know, it's out of whack. It's not the way God designed it. Verse 23, and not only this, but we ourselves, having the first fruit of the spirits, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. And there we see it. Okay. Creation, this inanimate creation, is aware, if you would, that something's wrong. How much more those that have been created in God's image. And our longing is, and he's already said we've been adopted, and we can find this where Paul does this. It's a twofold thing. We have been redeemed. There is a day of redemption in the future. There's that consummation of adoption, consummation of redemption. For in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? You know, this week I was in my thinking, and because, you know, what we're praying for is a miracle. And and I go, how many miracles have I witnessed? You know, I can come up with some that I think you know, I would testify that this happened, or, you know, at least I'm wondering. I thought I shared before about this time when Robin started having these headaches, and I thought she had a brain tumor, and that was back when you know, to get some kind of imaging was a huge thing, and it was a week off, and she had these headaches every night, and it was right after Eric was born. They, you know, their concern was that tumors grow rapidly during pregnancy, and we, you know, on that Sunday after church, that Sunday night, she's going to have it on the following Monday morning. So she's had headaches for 7 days, and she didn't have a headache that night, and the scan was, you know, negative, which always sounds wrong. You know, the term seen backwards. And he said, what do you do with that? Do you say, well, no, there wasn't anything there, just a wasted week of worry, which could have been the case. Or did God heal her? It's easy to dismiss things. But what I'm saying is, I look at that as when a time when God intervened, but I don't have that concrete evidence. So when have I experienced those miracles? And you know, you look at the miracles in some of the miracles of the Bible, when have I experienced those miracles? Sally's thinking that, you know, she experienced a miracle with Josh, because if he had stayed a few hundred feet closer to the beach, he wouldn't be here with us today likely. But see, it's those things. I mean, if we can look at that and we can say it's a miracle, but that's a different category. I'm not saying it wasn't, and I'm not saying God didn't intervene. But it's not the same concrete. It's not Jesus touching somebody's eyes and all of a sudden they see. And so I find myself saying, well, I'm praying for all these things, but when have I ever seen a miracle? And I'm reminded that when God called Moses, I didn't look this up today, I don't know exactly how it's worded, but he basically says, you know, I've heard the prayers of my people. They've been in bondage 400 years. You know, the people of the Exodus saw miracle after miracle. Unfortunately for them, the miracles didn't really lead them into the promised land. But they saw miracles after miracles, but their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, and their great-great-grandparents, and some more, they never saw an answer to prayer. So how do we evaluate those? You know, I mean, if you're looking for great comfort for my monologue, I guess. It's not coming at this point. But we can be quick to dismiss, and yet you look at this verse, for in hope we have been saved. But hope is that which is not, hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? You know, and maybe that's the thing. I used to think, I could see something like the Red Sea divide, that I would be different for life. I thought that for quite a few years, you know, several years. Kind of had that reoccurring thought. And then one day it occurred to me, why would I be different? Why do I think I'm so different from those that actually saw it? You know, the scene of the miracles doesn't necessarily change people. You remember Jesus and what is debated by some, whether it's actually classified as a parable or not, but with Lazarus and the rich man says, oh, let me come back and, you know, send somebody back from Hades to, you know, to testify, and so these people will turn around. And sounds pretty good to me. I mean that would impress people. And Jesus said, you know, or God at that point says, they have the scriptures, they have the testimony. You know, it's this issue of faith. That is the life of faith. And it's easy, you know, I like this thing of saying that, you know, kind of the mission of the church or where we're at, you know, is to be a people of faith. You know, to be a people of faith, to walk with God in faith. And that sounds really nice on bright sunny days when everything's going well. And yet, isn't that what it all is about, being people of faith? But if we hope for what we do not see with perseverance, we wait eagerly for it. In the same way, the Spirit also helps our weakness. For we do not know how to pray as we should, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. For he who searches the heart knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. See, I find great comfort in this passage, in that it reminds me very straightforward with Paul's words that we live in a fallen world, and that the Spirit is with us. The Spirit guides us. There is a life to be lived here. The sufferings may be great, but even when they are, they're dim compared to the eternal weight of glory. And when we ask ourselves those questions, if you're prone to be a skeptic, as I am at times, and say, what am I doing praying for a miracle? I've never seen a miracle. And to be reminded, everything we attest to is a miracle. And that's what makes it faith, to believe. And I, I'm not saying anything about the two that were on. I saw this clip from a news interview, ABC or CBS or something, but it was about faith. And there was a rabbi that's written a book about faith in tough times or something, and a Protestant woman that's written a book about faith in hard times. And so these two were on, and they were in the interviewer. And I really don't know what the two have to say, so I'm not trying to say this is all they have to say about it. But the way the interview is going to guide and take the things they say and what she's going to emphasize, it ended up no different than what if you went to some site and read about depression, saying one of the things to help you get out of depression is to do something for somebody else. And that's what this ended up. Now, that's not all I think they had to say, but that's where the interviewer kind of, what she could relate to. So often that's what faith becomes, just faith. But this is not just faith, it's faith in a living God. And it says here, back in 24, for in hope we have been saved. Now, it's very personal. Now, our salvation is based upon what God has done for us and our relationship to Him through faith. But hope that is seen is not hope. The same kind of words are used elsewhere about faith. That it's a confidence in God. And, so when we become discouraged with results or perplexed with what now or overwhelmed with, I don't know what to pray or how to say it, or I surely cannot be eloquent. To know that there's a Spirit that indwells us, and there is a Father that has adopted us, and what's required of us is to follow the leading of the Spirit and to be focused, at least in part, that perplexities of this fallen world have no comparison to the glory that God has for us.